Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. Special show today as we hit the NFL dead period. Not a lot going on in the NFL, so we're going to move our sights a little differently. A couple of authors coming on the show today, people who I believe would qualify as friends of the show in various ways. A little later, we're going to get to John Urschel, who's written the book. We're going to talk about that a little later on. But first, someone who somehow making his debut on this podcast approximately 6 years, I think, after we started discussing doing a podcast together, former colleague of mine at Grantland, former San Antonio Spurs employee, and current ESPN writer and the author of the new book, Sprawl Ball, a visual tour of the new era of the NBA. It's ESPN's Kirk Goldsberry. Kirk, how are you?
I am great, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm good. I do feel like I'm being used to promote a book that I probably at least deserve some credit for, but I'm going to ask you, how long have you had this book in the works for?
Oh, way too long. I mean, I started writing the book proposal, I think, in the Grantland era, so like 2015. So I guess it's 2019 now. I guess that would be 4 years. Why do you deserve credit for it again? Interesting question.
Just general connections, general networking. Mm-hmm. Being an all-around good guy, I think. I don't have a copy of the book yet, so I don't know if I'm named in the book. That's going to be determined whether we actually put this podcast episode out or not.
Well, that's because you're always flying around the world and you're very hard to mail things to.
Oh, so yeah.
We'll get you a copy. I'll send it to Florence.
Send it to Florence. Thank you. Better than the home of basketball. The home of hoops, Florence, Italy. But this is obviously going to be a really exciting book. You, of course, have done great work at Grantland, great work at the Spurs. We'll talk about not the work, maybe some other stuff related to the Spurs a little later on. And you're writing really cool stuff for us at ESPN now. But what in talking with you about this book in years past, before you actually wrote it, you know, I know that you've really sort of had this idea of where the league is going and sort of how the league is changing. And it seems like that's what you really hit in the contents of Sprawl Ball.
Yeah, dude. So I have been studying and mapping the shooting behavior of NBA players this whole decade. And it's been a remarkable decade to do that because arguably we've seen more changes in shooting behavior and shooting trends this decade than any other decade. So I started to notice these trends and I'm obsessing over them. And I also started to notice not a lot of people were talking about these crazy changes. And so I wanted to sort of try to document them or create a portrait of this drastic metamorphosis in the way that the game's being played in the NBA. So Sprawl Ball's an attempt to capture this crazy time in the league, where we were, where we are, and where we're going. And as always, there's a lot of charts, so...
Is there, like, was there a tipping point? Is there a player or a team? Like, obviously the Warriors take a lot of threes, and that's in itself meaningful, but is there a player who you think really typifies that or really sort of, you know, spurred that change along?
Well, that's a great question. I think, we give a three players their own chapter because we think they do. Steph, obviously, I think captured the hearts of America and a few championships by sort of showing that you could dominate the league from the perimeter. Nobody really won the MVP by being a great three-point shooter, and Steph did it twice, not to mention the championships and sort of the defining dynasty of the decade. So he gets a lot of attention. I think if people said he's the guy who emblemizes this trend, that's fine with me. I also think James Harden, who's sort of taking it in his own direction this year, by launching more unassisted threes than anybody in the history of the league. Mm-hmm. He's already the historical leader, the all-time leader in unassisted threes, which is a crazy stat considering that he's 29 years old. So he gets a chapter because I think he's very sort of symbolic of a lot of the trends in the sort of analytical era of basketball. And being part of Daryl and D'Antoni's world, I think he's such a compelling character. So I love to write about James Harden. I don't necessarily love to watch James Harden, but I love to write about James Harden. And then, of course, I have to write about LeBron, who is the defining player of the time, and isn't a great three-point shooter, but leads the league in 3-point assists this decade. So even though people say, oh, LeBron can't shoot threes or whatever, and he can kind of shoot them, he's pretty good now, but he created more threes for his teammates than anybody else this decade. So in a weird way, he's brought us here too with his teams. Three superstars, but make no mistake, Bill, it's all about the population of the league sort of coming into this 3-point era.
In terms of LeBron, I guess let's start there with LeBron, because obviously, like you said, the most important player of this generation. Was there a year? Was it one of the years where he changed teams? Was it a season where he, you know, did sort of change the way, you know, he shot? Because I'm assuming the guy that, you know, the sort of the shot chart we might see from LeBron in 2019 doesn't look very similar to the LeBron shot chart we would have seen 15 years ago.
No, he's actually sort of, this year the Lakers, not a great year, but interesting nonetheless. I think he sort of adopted the Harden approach, got rid of a lot of his mid-range. You know, when his rookie year, 2003-2004, he was a terrible jump shooter. It was like Ben Simmons or Giannis level shooting. I mean, he was really bad, and to his credit, he sort of worked it up. At first, it was elbow jumpers in Miami, and never really had a reliable three until later in his career, but was always taking a lot of mid-range shots until he got to L.A., and he really shaved out the mid-range this season and adopted sort of the analytically woke approach to shot selection that we've sort of come to associate with the Rockets. So that's an interesting thing to watch. But yeah, he's also the all-time, this century's leading scorer in the paint. I mean, if you're studying LeBron James, you're studying a guy who is very good at that sort of first analytically smart shot, the ones near the basketball hoop. And nobody scored near the paint more than him, or near the basket more than him this century. Especially when he was in Miami, he was racking up pretty insane numbers in the paint. And like, the smartest shot on the court is still a dunk or a layup, and he was better than anybody else in his prime at getting those shots.
Sure. And of course, one of the other smartest shots on the court is a free throw, which would naturally lead us to James Harden, who you mentioned not loving watching him. And I think there's maybe a little bit of a separation you have to make there, because of course you watched him as a member of the Spurs organization where you were competing against him and having to, you know, sort of deal with him as a problem to be hit. And then also, you know, now as an analyst, but also as a fan, I mean, are there different reasons you might like or dislike watching James Harden in those different scenarios?
Yeah, I mean, and he's terrifying from a game plan perspective. In 2017, we had to game plan against him in the playoffs, and it was terrifying because he's simply put, he's just one of the most dominant offensive players we've seen. He's brilliant. So as an opponent, you very much respect what he's able to do. He can win games almost single-handedly. He creates shots for his teammates at sort of unheralded levels. But as a fan, putting myself in the fan world, yeah, it's kind of annoying. I think that's the word I would use. Some of his gamesmanship is annoying. But then let me put my analyst hat on. It's brilliant. Everything he does is very, very smart. When he's just flopping around, drawing a 3-point shooting foul, as a fan, you're annoyed. As an analyst, you're like, man, this guy gets it. Like, he knows where the cheapest points on the court are. And as you say, they're at the free throw line. And one of the defining stats for Harden, in my opinion, is the fact that when he won his MVP, the first MVP last year, he was the first MVP in NBA history who had more free throws than field goals made at the time of his award. Wow. So he has gone to the line so much and taken advantage of those whistles more than any other superstar. And what's crazy is that you would think somebody who has that many free throws would be like a big or a power forward or a center. Somebody's always, you know, messing around in the paint, but he's a guard, which is crazy. So he's a fascinating player to study. He's terrifying to game plan against. If you're a fan, you know, it's not for me to say what everybody should think as a fan. I know I'm certainly not alone to think it's kind of annoying some of the stuff he does. But as an analyst, you have to say this guy might be the most sort of analytically intelligent player that we've seen in the league in a very long time.
So that element of Harden's sort of, you know, abiding by the rules of the game and taking advantage of the rules of the game, but maybe not abiding by the spirit of the rules of the game, if I'm framing it correctly.
That's great. Yeah.
Like, would you want to legislate that out? Is there a way you think it's possible to legislate some of that stuff out?
Well, yeah, I think it is. I mean, you know, you award these three-shot fouls for things that are clearly not sort of organic field goal attempts, and that was one of the issues. And I think allowing the refs to have a little bit more judgment on what exactly is a natural shot attempt, and just giving a sight out of bounds is one of the things they've already done. They started doing that this year. Similar with the rip-through rule a few years ago, where mm-hmm. players were intentionally sort of ripping the ball through and drawing shooting fouls. Yeah, we can sort of change the rules to sort of encourage or discourage certain behaviors. After all, that's what sports are all about. It's a rule base designed to encourage certain types of strategies. And Harden is a prophet. Like, he's showing us how to get the most bang for your buck out there. You know, the thing is that kills me with Harden, though, Bill, is like, he would be great no matter what. It's mm-hmm. not just about the annoying stuff. So I'm not a Harden hater. Like, he is so talented. What he's doing with the step back three this year, his ability to drive, his ability to read the floor and create for his teammates is simply world class. He's a superstar mm-hmm. without this annoying stuff. But yeah, he's just wired to think like that. He thinks like a chess player out there. As Pablo Torre says, he plays basketball like a tax attorney. Like, he's just finding the loopholes and the margins and exploiting them all the way and to the bank. And he's not doing any of the inefficient stuff. So, I mean, yeah, he is just, he's like, what I always like to say is like, he's a mirror. He's reflecting the values that the rule base has created back at us. And if you don't like some of those things, it's not his fault. It's the rule base's fault.
So then let me ask you, in terms of the game that we're seeing in 2019 and sort of the rules structure that is creating value structure for that game, has the league sort of outgrown the current structure of the NBA, whether it be something like the way to sort of draw fouls that you mentioned, or even possibly the structure of the 3-point line as a whole?
Yeah, I think it has. And I think if analytics hasn't ruined anything, I think if anything, it's accelerated trends that were already happening and awakenings mm-hmm. that were sort of gradually happening. So we're seeing incredibly quick year over year trends in things like 3-point rate. If you look at the history of 3-point shooting, three of the four biggest year-over-year increases have been in the last 3 years. So wow. The league is falling in love with the three-point shot, increasingly so. And people have been like, oh, don't you think this is going to slow down or plateau? I'm like, well, if the last 3 years are any indication, remember, I started writing this book about sprawl 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. In the last 3 years, it's only increased. So I do think it's time to move the 3-point line, Bill, for a couple of reasons. I think the shot is too easy for too many people. Mm-hmm. And I think it is threatening sort of the diversity of the game. And the way I frame that in the book is like, basketball has sort of organically, evolved to have five position groups, you mm-hmm. know, point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward, center. I think if we see a version of the game where those five groups aren't each able to thrive, I think it's concerning. And I think what's happening right now with the spread out offenses is that big men, especially, are finding it harder and harder, to thrive. Not to mention like some tried and true forms of the sport, like low post play are endangered as well. So I would argue it's time to explore those changes, and the book tackles what we could do and why we would do these things. But I also say it's not up to me. I'm just an analyst. And one of the things that I point out is that it's up to the NBA. Like, what does the NBA want to see? What sport do they want to engineer? Mm-hmm. What are their values? I would like to think that they want to preserve some of that sort of diversity of tactics and the diversity of styles within the position groups and the position groups themselves. And if that's true, then I do think it's time to change.
I mean, you know what I'm going to say. I'm going to play devil's advocate here. You know, just in terms of thinking about, you know, growing up watching the Patrick Ewing Knicks, like, that was not an aesthetically pleasing basketball team. Like, I don't remember sitting here thinking, man, I am watching the sport in its highest form here. You know, like, it was successful, yeah. You know, to an extent, but
why does everybody choose the Knicks? Everybody who brings this up to me is like, dude, do you want to go back to the Anthony Mason Knicks? No, I don't want to go there either. It's not an either or. I reject the premise, but it's just so funny that everybody's like, did you like those Knicks teams? you know, by the way, I did. But I don't want to watch that anymore either. And I don't think it's, I reject the premise, like I said. I don't think it's like either we do this or we go back to 1996.
Okay, fair.
I would say we have an opportunity, and this is a big part of the end of the book, that analytics can be leveraged at the league level to engineer an aesthetic that we want, a future aesthetic that is diverse, that stewards sort of all of these position groups and just maintains the diversity of the game. And one of the more sort of provocative points I think I make at the end of the book is like, we could redraw the three-point line every year based on the shooting abilities of the year's previous shooters.
Wow.
So we could delineate it exactly to place. Let's say the league wanted to make the three-point shot worth 1 point on average. Well, where would the line have to be for it to, for the population of shooters to hit 33.33% of their shots? Well, we can look at the shooting data and do a pretty good job of estimating that right now. And then why does it have to be in the same place the next year? It could move slightly year over year if that's the kind of thing they wanted to do. My point isn't to say that I want to do that. Mm-hmm. It's my point is to say the league could be innovative with how they're using data in the same way that teams have been over the last two decades that have driven these changes. The league can engineer changes in design and aesthetic and preserve aesthetics that they want to see, as opposed to just sort of sitting back. And I would say this is another sort of basic point I make throughout the book, is that if you like the NBA in 2019, then you like a league that has been very, very willing to change its rules over the years. Remember, this is a league where goaltending was legal before it wasn't. You couldn't dunk the ball. There was no three-point shot. The lane has changed from a key to a lane to a wider lane. Mm-hmm. The NBA right now is a product of, you know, 70, 80 years of tinkering. But in the midst of arguably the biggest sort of aesthetic upheaval in the sport's history, the league is very conservative right now, which is just a weird combination. So I just argue that it's time to get back to our roots in terms of tinkering and messing with stuff and trying to make the sport even better with rule changes, which is not new at all.
I mean, but do you think the league office perceives this to be an aesthetically unappealing era or an aesthetically unappealing game at the moment to the point where they would want to consider making changes?
No, I don't. And I think that's a great point. And I think a lot of people are going to hear this and say, oh, man, he doesn't like it. I love the way the game looks right now. But it's like going to Glacier National Park 15 years ago and be like, the Glacier looks great. What's going on? Why do people care? Like the year-over-year trends are so dramatic.
It's exactly like, the same.
If you like the way the league looks right now, then counterintuitively, you should think about conservation. Because every year, post-ups go way down, mid-range goes way down, three-points go way up. So if you like what you're watching right now, then, again, you should be tinkering with things to try to preserve that, because in 10 years it's not going to be there. And again, I come back to the Houston Rockets, Bill. Mm-hmm. Again, I think they're very smart and deserve a lot of credit for doing what they're doing. But if it's true, like many of my friends don't like watching them, well, those trends are the dominant trends of the future. So if you don't like watching the Rockets, again, I think you should be like, what can we do to preserve certain things?
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say this. I feel like if you're, I brought up that you're a former Spurs employee. Granted, the team, it feels like that is most at odds, perhaps, and I could be wrong, most at odds with that sort of modern ideal of what, you know, of what's being rewarded right now in the NBA would probably be the San Antonio Spurs, no?
Mm-hmm. So, no, you're right. Well, here's the thing, and people, I think that's fair. That's fair to say that to me. What I like to remind people is the book itself came out of an article I wrote in Grantland in 2014. And you can look back at this right after some team named the San Antonio Spurs won the NBA championship. Mm-hmm. Literally the first piece I wrote was, is it time to move the 3-point line back, after their championship? Because, you know, in that series, they'd taken a third of their shots, which was very high for the time, from three-point range, and were making them at like 40% of the time. And the Heat had pretty similar numbers in that series. Mm-hmm. And I had argued way back then that the shot had become too easy for too many people. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we were talking about the Spurs being the champions who had done it. So I'd like to remind people, yeah, this is not a new idea. Certainly, it doesn't have anything to do with my time at the Spurs. Mm-hmm. The thing I did learn at the Spurs is that, you know, they look at the game of basketball in a different way. I mean, as sort of stewards of the sport, like, what do we want to see? And that sort of opened my eyes to the idea that the league should be probably doing more to monitor and mess with gameplay and try to preserve and create the game they want analytically. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, I keep coming back to that. This is an old idea, but since I started it, the shifts have become even more drastic. Mm-hmm. One of the things I found out is that last year's Rockets team was the first team in NBA history to shoot over half of their shots from three-point range. So I joke in that arena, they should call it the 2-point line because they're, they're more likely to shoot behind it than in front of it. So I think that's really interesting too. But yeah, I mean, I get that a lot of people might not agree with some of these points, but the book itself isn't sort of an essay trying to convince anybody of anything other than that the holy moly, these changes are drastic. And if we don't do something about them, the league is going to be sort of unrecognizable in 10 years.
All right, Kirk. Well, I'm going to ask you how you would solve the NBA's minor crisis in a moment. But first, I want to talk about our friends at ZipRecruiter. Guys, hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. No fun. Today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. That's my promo code. We'll get to that in a second. But first, just so you know about ZipRecruiter, it sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and then invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. You can't beat that. And ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. No waiting for weeks, no sorting through mediocre resumes to get the one that actually works out. ZipRecruiter gets you the right candidate fast. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. No one else has this web address. ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now back to the show. Not saying that this is what's, you know, what's proposed by the book or what's not proposed by the book. I'm not saying that this is what the league needs to be. Just for you, as someone who watches the game closely, let's say Adam Silver leaves this offseason to start a gambling startup. Let's say somehow mm-hmm. you are made NBA commissioner and you have carte blanche to change the court and possibly change the rules of the game. What are you making the three-point line? Where are you pushing it back to? And is there anything else that comes to mind? It's like, this is an obvious rule change I am making day one to you know, make the game better over the course of the next 10 years.
Yeah. So let's say the NBA goes from Silver to Goldsberry, as you say. And we want to make a better sport. And I'm in charge and I'm a dictator.
Sure.
No, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to convene some coaches and some experts and I'm going to throw out 4 or 5 different ideas and I'm going to say, do you guys think this would be good or bad? And it'd be people like Coach Popovich or Doc Rivers, people who have coached in the league. Executives, maybe some players from the Players Association, and say, here's some rules that we think would be better for the league. But I think the first thing I would do is try to assemble the right group of people mm-hmm. That could not just make random haphazard changes, but discuss changes and potential changes and evaluate how they would change the product on the court. Here are some of the ones I would consider. I'd consider simply just moving the line back. I think that's the most obvious idea that people are going to start talking about this summer. Mm-hmm. Moving it back 2 feet. If you look at the shooting data, that'll reduce the shooting efficiency overall in the league, probably about 2 or 3 percentage points, and reduce those margins, which has killed the mid-range in the post game. Those margins will be reduced. And I think the 3-point shot will still be valuable, but for a smaller population of players. Mm-hmm. And that will breathe some life back into the 2-point area. Another more fun idea I would consider is allowing home teams to draw the 3-point line however they want it in their arena within some reasonable guidelines. Which some people think is the stupidest thing I've ever said, but other people think that's a really fun idea. So, I would like to know what the other people would think about that. Mm-hmm. It would restore some home court advantage and some fun and some sort of, challenging analytical parts for those in the team environment. And then, what else could we do? Oh, allowing goaltending on threes. This would be a crazy change, but it would also make shooters sort of think twice in the same way that a quarterback has to worry not only about the pass being tipped at the line of scrimmage, mm-hmm. but it being intercepted downfield.
Sure.
Spot-up shooters are pretty sort of carefree dudes right now. There's not much to worry about. And big men aren't valued as much. So that's a crazy idea. I don't think people would go for it, but I think it's worth considering. Remember, goaltending was legal before it wasn't. And then the last one, speaking of the big man in the post game, is actually narrowing the lane, Bill, in the two-point mm-hmm. area, to enable post-up players to get closer touches. Mm-hmm. You know, that lane has been widened twice because people were posting up too much and it was too easy and it was deemed too efficient. Mm-hmm. And so these were intentional interventions to decrease the efficiency of like the dominant aesthetic of the time. Mm-hmm. So I think, okay, let's throw the big man a bone. Nobody's posting up anymore. Let's make that thing a little narrower. See if we can encourage that behavior that we've lost in the last few years as well. So those are some things I would throw out there. But the most important thing I'll say is like, I want to get the feedback from people who, mm-hmm. really would understand what would happen if we made these changes.
Ask someone who does not understand what would happen if you made these changes. Let me ask you this. You did not bring up the idea of a four-point shot. Does that make sense to you?
A four-point shot is the dumbest thing in the world because we haven't killed the big man fast enough already. Like, we haven't reduced the game to a jump shooting contest already. Are we trying to open up the game more? I mean, we're seeing teams like the Bucks and the Rockets thrive in part because they're just stationing guys outside the three-point line. What do we want to see? More guys standing further and further away from the basketball hoop? You know, the famous Damian Lillard shot from round one of this playoffs, that was a 35, 37-foot shot. Mm-hmm. And these guys are making that at 35, 40% of the time. And I say these guys, Steph Curry, Dame Lillard, Trae Young, an increasingly, you know, potent group of shooters from that distance. Why would we need a four-point line? What's the point? I think we need to breathe some life back into the two-point game and that sort of diversity of scoring.
You said diversity of options. You don't have to have a four-point shooter. You can put the four-point shot far out enough that it's going to be a, you know, less than a 35% shot of making it. I'm just saying, is it at least on the table for you? It seems like that is the answer to that question.
I think a right shoulder fadeaway off the left block should be worth 4 points.
So you want it to be awesome.
That way that way I can see a post player play again. There are not going to be many left. Yeah, no. I mean, there are these experimental basketball courts that are sort of popping up at AAU in different venues where mm-hmm. it's not simply like linear ideas for whether there should be a three-point shot or a four-point shot or whatever. It's like there's patches of court where that's worth certain many points. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bunch of crazy stoner ideas out there for how we could augment the sport. I don't think a four-point shot is worth considering, and I challenge anybody who does to explain why, other than, yeah, it's fun, and that's a good reason, don't get me wrong. But from like an engineering of a sport perspective, what does that accomplish that we don't already have accomplished in the current NBA?
All right. So you will cover this more in your book, Sprawl Ball. We'll plug it more in a second. One more question for you, Kirk Goldsberry. And I know I can't really ask you about the work you did with the Spurs. I'm not expecting you to talk about that. I don't want you to disappear one day. I want you to be working for ESPN for a long time. What I can ask you about, though, I hope I can ask you about, is that Baxter Holmes, our colleague at ESPN, recently wrote about Greg Popovich's generosity when it comes to dinners, and certainly his knowledge of wine is well known. So I'm asking you, do you have any memories during your time with the Spurs over the past few years of your first Pop dinner or a notable Pop dinner that you can remember that would make for entertaining podcast fodder?
Well, there's a bunch of them. I mean, they are legendary. They were unlike anything I'd ever been to. I mean, the whole basketball operations group is invited, which means the players, the coaches, the front office all get together and break bread at a really nice restaurant. And it's communion. We come together. We get to know each other. I always say there's a few assistant coaches where I can point to when I became friends with them. They went from sort of professional colleagues to personal friends because of these dinners. And that is by design. And you talk about the Spurs culture, and Baxter did a wonderful job of outlining that. This is fun for Pop. He loves to go to restaurants. It's his passion. He wants to share it. But he's also running a very intimate organization of human beings trying to be very cohesive. And he achieves this culture through these dinners in part. And I could tell you from firsthand, you know, in 2016, when we lost in Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. we had a dinner, my first one in the playoffs. And again, we ran out this whole restaurant. It's 11:30 at night. Stay there for 2 or 3 hours and just talk about stuff. Not just the basketball game that we just went through, which was intense, but what's going on with our families, what's going on in the world. And this is awesome. It really was one of the sort of best parts about working for Coach Pop and the Spurs. And it is, as Baxter points out, like one of the secrets to how he's been able to keep that culture intact for so long. But yeah, they're really good. I don't know anything about wine. I know that I like to drink it, probably too much. But you know, I'm not one of these connoisseurs, and Pop is, and so forth. But yeah, these dinners are really good. I can't overstate how important I think they are to the culture. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised more teams don't try to do it. But not every coach can pull that off either. The key thing I would say about Coach Pop is that he's legitimately sort of, the empathy is just so good and so true that you want to go to dinner with him. I don't think a lot of coaches have that relationship with their front office. I don't think a lot of coaches have that relationship with their players. So even inviting people to dinner and getting them to show up in the NBA is an achievement, let alone doing it several times a year. So, you know, I think it's a lot of this stuff coming together, Bill, and the dinners are special. And if you haven't read that article, folks, Baxter Holmes put this up a few weeks ago, and it was really, really true, coming from somebody who worked in the front office for a number of years.
Now, you're also a Patriots fan. And you know how, like, it happens with the Spurs a little bit as well, but with the Patriots, like, you know, you'll hire someone from the Patriots. You'll hear about someone getting hired from the Patriots, and they'll go somewhere else, and they'll be like, yeah, I'm going to bring along the Patriots ideals, but it gets, like, warped along the way, and it doesn't actually resemble what the Patriots were doing or what perhaps the Spurs were doing. I'm just worried we're going to get teams now that have, like, you know, the entire front office going to Burger King at 2 in the morning to resemble what the Spurs are doing.
Well, you can't replicate it. Because it starts with that human being at the top. Mm-hmm. And you compare it to the Patriots, like, Bill Belichick is a phenomenal coach, but for very different reasons.
Sure.
Than Coach Pop. Coach Pop builds, like, sincere connections with his team and his players and his staff. And I'm not saying Bill Belichick doesn't do that. I wouldn't know. But it seems like Pop cares more about that person-to-person connection in his organization. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's hard to build that. I don't know. But yeah, I don't imagine the Patriots going to these dinners, in part because the roster is so much bigger. I mean, what do they have, 47 guys?
53.
Plus the 53, and then they got a huge amount of operations groups. So it's just harder. Basketball is really easy to do that with. There's 15 players, and then there's, you know, a handful of coaches, a handful of front office people. You can fit in a restaurant together.
All right. So Sprawl Ball is going to be a wild success. Sprawl Ball 2 covering the NFL is going to argue that NFL rosters should be 12 people long. Is that correct?
Yeah. Sprawl Ball 2 is mostly about how football should get rid of the forward pass. No, I'm just kidding. But like the forward pass, the three-point line has sort of deformed the sport in a great way and made the sport, you know, fit for another century of thriving.
All right. Well, if people want to check out Sprawl Ball, Kirk, where can they purchase it? Is it at
wherever books are sold?
Bookstores? Every book, wherever books are sold. That's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah. Well, maybe not at the alternative bookstore in your city, but I would say that Amazon is easy, Barnes and Noble is easy. But if you're like me and you like to support independent bookstores, indie bound, even if you're on your computer. As a network of the country's finest independent booksellers. So I would support IndieBound. If you're lazy like me, Amazon works too.
Awesome. Well, Kirk, it's always a pleasure. We're going to come back on the show in a moment with John Urschel. So back here in a moment with the Bill Barnwell Show. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. Joining me now, a good friend of mine, someone who I was on a panel with at the MIT Sloan Conference several years ago, a former Ravens offensive lineman, and the author of the new book, Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football. It is Mr. John Urschel. John, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. I years ago, when I first became aware of you, the way I described you was the person who is overqualified for my job in literally every single way. So thankfully, you have gone in a much different path and a much more intellectually stimulating path, in that you are, of course, currently getting your PhD from mathematics at MIT. And you, of course, were most recently also, as your CV mentions, a American football player for the Baltimore Ravens.
Yes. No, I think it's it's an important part of my CV to, you know, let them know, you know, other work experience.
And I got a copy of your book a couple weeks ago. It was tremendous. I knew the story a little bit, of course, from knowing you and sort of reading stuff about you in the past. But then getting it sort of fleshed out was really cool to see. And it's a really, I think, fun book if you're someone who has twin passions, someone who goes on a path that maybe you weren't expecting, and someone who then veers off that path for reasons that are meaningful. And I think it's a really great read. And I want to start from the beginning. Let's start, when you were a child. Of course, you had more than one passion, and it seems like you realized you were, or at least your parents realized, or your mother realized, that you were someone who was really passionate and skilled in math long before you really developed any sort of interest or ability in football.
Oh yeah, that's certainly true. And I mean, whether or not I truly had some sort of great math ability when I was very little, I think often, it's hard to tell whether, my mom just, happened to think she saw something in me and then she started pushing math, or whether, it was her pushing math that caused me to be good at it. But when I was little, I was always very good at recognizing shapes. And so one of the earliest things that sort of led her to think that she should push me towards, quantitative things, is one of my favorite things to do would be to learn different shapes and then try to recognize them when we were like out on walks or when we were out in the world.
Interesting. And then you didn't start playing football until you were much older.
Yes, for a number of reasons. One, of course, my mother was sort of, in some ways, she was very concerned about my safety.
Of course.
And also, I was quite overweight when I was little, and so football leagues have weight limits for good reason, at least Pop Warner leagues. And so there were some barriers to me playing football, although it was something that I knew I wanted to do just because I. When I was little, I sort of idolized my father in many ways. And one of those ways was that, he always, seemed like a sort of, like a tough person. And he played college football. And he actually had a chance to play professionally, but decided to do his residency rather than play professional football, given how much they were being paid back in those days.
Yes, I would imagine. Certainly a more sustainable long-term profession. Was there a moment, I guess in both cases, in football and in math, where, as an adolescent, maybe even as a teenager, was there a moment in both cases where you sort of felt like a level of mastery, where you felt like, oh, I'm not just someone who does this and I kind of likes it, like I'm really special and I have a real genuine ability to kind of do both these things?
I see. Yes, I've always been, for better or worse, I've always been slow to recognize this. So I would say in high school, I didn't start realizing this with respect to football until I started getting interest from college teams. I didn't really think I was that special of a football player. And I have to admit, even to this day, I don't think I was ever really that special of a talent. I think it was a sport that, I love, and I just worked really, really hard at it. I don't think I was ever, some physical freak that sort of impressed people just off of my sort of raw talent. But more than anything, it was a lot of hard work and just seeing that, okay, I had enough talent to, you know, to make me a part of the conversation. With respect to math, I didn't even realize that, you know, I had, you know, a serious math ability until I got to college, really. I was the strongest math student in my high school, but, you know, being sort of the best person at math, you know, within sort of a small community that you know, this this isn't a very big sample size. And I'd say for both these things, it was sort of when I realized how I stacked up sort of against people all across the country that I started to realize, you know, I might be not too bad at both of these things. And being good at them paired with, you know, quite frankly, just loving both of them a great amount, I think it was, you know, it was a recipe for success.
So you didn't start at Penn State, which is where you ended up going. You didn't start as a math major, correct?
That's correct. I didn't. I while I enjoyed math growing up, and maybe enjoying math isn't even the right way to say it. I'm someone who has always loved puzzles. Ever since I was little, and even to this day. And that was really where my love of math came from, this sort of desire to sort of solve the unknown. And I was very sort of a disinterested student. I majored in aerospace engineering because my mother told me I was going to major in aerospace engineering. And I didn't even know what a mathematician was until I got to college. And it wasn't until I started taking math courses for my engineering major and sort of taking college level math, which is quite different than sort of the math you learn in high school, that I really realized that this was, you know, such a passion of mine.
In the book, you do also tell a story that I think is really interesting about the college admissions process and your, you know, visiting different schools and how you very nearly, if the timing had been slightly different, ended up going possibly to the school of your mother's dreams as opposed to the school that you actually ended up going to.
Yes, that is true. My mother, so first of all, my mother has many schools of her dreams.
Okay, sure.
But Stanford was a school that she was extremely excited about. Stanford was recruiting me, in fact. And it was actually an interesting sort of series of events because Stanford was recruiting me and Penn State was as well. And this was very, very late in the process. I was sort of, people were trying to finish out their classes and I was, you know, one of the last two or three people that college teams were trying to get. And Stanford just stopped talking to me altogether. And so Penn State offered me, I made a visit and I committed immediately. And the following Monday, getting back from Penn State, I get a call from Harbaugh, then the head coach of Stanford, saying that he wanted to offer me a scholarship and that sort of my case fell through the cracks because the person recruiting me, who was their offensive line coach, just quit. And so it took them some time to sort of, you know, to get everything worked out. And he made me an offer. I told him I had committed to Penn State. And he told me that, you know, oh, that's fine that you committed to Penn State, but still, you should come out to Stanford this weekend and, you know, just take a look. Just so you know what you could be, you know, what you could have. Sure. And sadly, I told him no, that I had already committed to Penn State, even though Stanford was not only my mother's dream school. I love Stanford.
Right.
I mean, I have to admit, I love Stanford to this day. Palo Alto is beautiful. The palm trees, it's just an amazing place. And yeah, I mean, I still love Stanford to this day, but at the time, and I think I'm still happy. Well, okay, first of all, I'm extremely happy with my decision based on how things turned out, but I sort of made my decision sort of based off the idea that, you know, I really gave Penn State my word.
Right.
And that was something that really meant something to me. Like that was, you know, actually, you know, this was a valuable thing that I possessed. Like when I promise I'm going to do something, I do it.
So at Penn State, was there again, like, was there a point where you realized, hey, I want to pursue, you know, both these careers and I'm going to be able perhaps to pursue both these careers at a more meaningful level after I do graduate from Penn State?
So this was actually something that didn't even cross my mind. I'm not much of a planner. I have to say, I very much just love playing college football. To this day, I would say my years playing college football were my favorite years playing football, period. Mm-hmm. Much more so than high school or NFL. Wow. And I loved being at Penn State. I loved playing football for Penn State. And I was obsessed with math. I would, any math book I could get my hands on, I would try to devour it. Mm-hmm. I was every single day, I was like a kid in a candy shop, like just couldn't wait to, get to football practice, to do training, to, to learn about different areas of math, to mm-hmm. try to do research. It was really an amazing time in my life, and I wasn't really thinking about what was coming after. Mm-hmm. I thought that once I finished my career at Penn State, I would apply to a PhD program, get my PhD, and become an academic. Mm-hmm. The thought of the NFL didn't actually come into play until after my junior year, when first of all, I started getting put on on lists for sort of recruits and projected reasonably high draft pick, mm-hmm. and my coaches at Penn State sat me down after my junior year and told me, John, we think you should certainly come back for another year and you shouldn't think about going out early. And this was mm-hmm. This was the moment where I thought, okay, the NFL, this is a real thing.
Right.
Yes.
In terms of, sort of planning your future, I think most human beings, I would say the vast, vast majority of human beings will look at this situation and say, okay, I have to choose between one of these two opportunities. Either I'm going to pursue a math degree at a doctorate level, or I'm going to play in the NFL. Those are both full-time jobs.
Yes.
You, however, made the decision secretly to do both those things.
Yes. And first of all, I want to say that it wasn't really a conscious decision in the sense that at first I had decided I'm going to play professional football.
Okay.
And I'm going to keep up with my mathematics. I'm going to read a lot and I'm still going to do research and I'm going to be an active mathematician. Mm-hmm. Because I do truly believe that you're capable of, if you have multiple passions, you're capable of pursuing multiple things at a high level. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I'm not sure I would recommend to your listeners to attempt two full-time jobs at the same time.
Yeah, I mean,
I have to admit, first of all, I highly recommend, life's too short to not, pursue your passions and sort mm-hmm. of do the things you want to do, but two full-time jobs, which both of which are sort of more than a full-time job, depending on what time of year you're in,
right,
at least for football. I don't recommend this. And the way it came about was, I thought, okay, I'm going to play professional football. I'm going to play for, like 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then I'm going to retire, and then I'm going to go get my PhD.
Right.
But then, after my first year in the league, I had this feeling that something was missing. Mm-hmm. I was reading math, I was doing math research, but I really missed being a part of an academic environment. Mm-hmm. I really missed coursework. I really missed being around other mathematicians. It's something sort of very nice to be around other people who are really passionate about the same thing as you. And it's a very nice environment, and I really missed it. I just missed academia. And so I decided, I need to start my PhD. I need to get back into academia because right now I'm just not happy mm-hmm. with sort of what I've done, and I think I'm selling myself short.
So you surreptitiously, maybe it's fair to say, start your PhD. And then that was, I believe, that second year with the Ravens was when you suffered your first concussion, correct?
Yes. Yes, that's true.
And you write in the book about how it impacted, you know, obviously, I'm sure, you know, you had thought about the possible repercussions of concussions, and you thought about the, you know, impact it might have on you, but it had, it seems like a very specific, you know, direct impact on not only your football career, of course, but also then your studies as well.
Oh, absolutely. It was, I got a concussion in training camp my second year, and I got like knocked unconscious. Mm-hmm. In some play, I won't go through the details, but I sort of got a blow to the side of my head where I wasn't expecting it based off sort of what the defense did. Mm-hmm. And so after that, I had issues, as people do when they have, you know, serious concussions. I had some nausea, I had sensitivity to light, I had sort of mood swings, and really, I had a problem concentrating, and sort of like doing high-level math was just sort of out of the question. Mm-hmm. And I know it was out of the question because, trust me, I tried. Mm-hmm. And it was an extremely frustrating time for me because, you know, mathematics, something that, you know, I really loved doing, I was just unable to do, as well as being unable to play football, the other thing I really loved doing. So it was It was quite an upsetting time for me because the two things I love doing, like, I can't do right now.
Right. And that was in 2015. And then you come back, you play a full season in 2015. You're back for another year in 2016. At that point, are you thinking, like, are you, is math sort of calling you more after that first concussion? Are you thinking less about the NFL, or do you still have the same level of passion about, sort of both those things?
I think if I'm really honest with myself, mm-hmm. every single semester I spent at MIT, I came to love math just so much more, mm-hmm. and football just came to take a little bit more of a backseat every single semester. Mm-hmm. Like, my time at MIT has been nothing short of just like amazing and special, and it's really been sort of one of the best experiences I've ever had. Mm. And awesome. Every single sort of time when, you know, it was time for off-season training to start, I was always quite sad to leave MIT. Mm-hmm.
Did you have thoughts of retiring in those moments, or was it just, you know, I'm going to make this work for a few years, and then I still love football enough, I'm still passionate enough about football that I'm willing to sort of make that sacrifice?
Oh, no. So I wasn't sort of like, this wasn't a sort of thought of like, oh, man, I don't want to leave MIT. Like, mm-hmm. am I going to retire? It was more of, okay, I have to go back. I'm going to do this. Once I get back into the swing of things, this feeling is going to go away. Because, right. John, you really enjoy football, and you're going to enjoy this. And I had to, like, tell myself this. I had to convince myself of this. And it was true. You know, I would get back to Baltimore, I would get into off-season activities, and I would enjoy myself, and all would be well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was sort of a game I had to sort of play with myself, leaving MIT, but this was a game that sort of worked.
Mm-hmm. So then 2017 comes around, the middle of training camp with the Ravens. The New York Times publishes an article linking football to a greatly increased chance of suffering from CTE. Later in life, and then a few days later, you retire. And I think in the immediate aftermath of that sort of decision, there was a lot of things written about your decision. You were talked about in a lot of places, which you mentioned was not exactly what you wanted to do with your retirement announcement. It seems like you wanted to just sort of, you know, move on and slip away and sort of not have to, you know, have to be sort of a, you know, sort of a talking point for the future of football. But how would you characterize the relationship between that report coming out and your decision? I mean, what was it, the primary driver? Was it the straw that broke the camel's back? What, you know, how would that figure into your decision? And what were you thinking when you sort of did make the call to move on from football?
Yeah, it was sort of a very interesting thing. I mean, the report came out like 4 days before training camp, and I think I retired right before the first practice, like right before the first day of practice. Mm-hmm. I know I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but I think this is sort of, in hindsight, it's a very funny story because everyone that I tell it to thinks this is quite hilarious, although I didn't think it was hilarious at the time. So, okay, so first of all, you know, after my third year, I think I really started asking myself, am I going to play one more year? Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure. And then, you know, I think, you know what? No, I am going to play one more year. And I go and I get back for sort of off-season training, and then I find out I'm going to be a father. Mm-hmm. And then I start saying, well, do I want to play another year? Or should I just retire now? Or should I retire after my fourth year? Like, what is best? Mm-hmm. Do I really want to play another year? Or do I want to sort of, you know, focus on math at MIT and sort of enjoy that I had a good NFL career, enjoy that I'm quite healthy and that, you know, I'm going to have, you know, a nice, healthy, long life, you know, doing math and raising my daughter. And I keep going back and forth, and I probably changed my mind right around like 8 to 10 times. Mm-hmm. And then sort of I eventually decide, like, okay, you know, I think I'm going to sort of do this season. But like with about 65% confidence, and then this New York Times thing comes out, and, you know, of course this plays a role, although sort of this isn't sort of a causation, but, you know, it's something to keep in mind, although a lot of things with that study, I think, sort of the headlines are overstated.
Right.
But I, you know, this plays a role in sort of, you know, we continue to discuss, you know, talking about it with Louisa, I'm talking about it with my friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eventually, like finally, like at the last minute before sort of training camp starts, I finally decide, no, I'm retiring. I'm going back to MIT. I'm focusing on math. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to, you know, raise my daughter and sort of, I've loved my time in the NFL and like, I wouldn't trade it for the world, but I'm like so excited to like focus on math full time and try to be the best mathematician and father I can be. And the hilarious part of this story starts now, because the main thing I'm concerned about is, like, I have a real concern because I think, man, John, this report just came out like 3 days ago. This is going to be a news story. People are going to be bothering you about this. And, like, I was really dreading it because I have to admit, I mean, okay, I am somewhat of a public person, just sort of based off the things I've done, and I try to sort of do sort of good outreach for math, but mm-hmm. I really sort of value my privacy in a serious way, and I was really not looking forward to this because I thought, you know, maybe some people will bother me, mm-hmm. and then I found out that Joe Flacco is not practicing for the first day of training camp because something's wrong with his shoulder, or I don't know what. And he's, like, not going to be practicing for the first week or whatever. And this news, like, and news of this just came out, like, the day before within, like, our circle. But I don't think it came out to the media yet. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, of course, Joe, like, I feel bad for you, man. Sorry that, you know, you're having a tiny bit of shoulder issues. You can't practice. But, Joe, you're going to be fine. And this is the perfect cover I need to retire nice and quietly, and no one will notice because everyone will be talking about Joe Flacco not practicing. They won't even notice I'm gone. And oh my Lord, how, for a smart person, how wrong and sort of naive, I'll even say stupid was I for even thinking for half a second that that was the case. I retire, and I'm telling you, my phone is blowing up like... Mm-hmm. Like, I'm getting phone call after phone call. Like, one phone call ends, and then another phone call, like, immediately starts. I got, like, 500 phone calls in the very first day, all from, like, people I don't know, like, whatever news outlets.
Right.
To the point where, like, it really, like, I legitimately did not feel well just because sort of all of these people bothering me. Mm-hmm. Not because of, like, retirement or anything. I was perfectly right. happy with this. But, you know, I, yeah, just... Some people sort of really love attention. It really can sort of can really do me in. Mm-hmm. Interesting story, I think.
Yeah, Joe Flacco being a good teammate, suffering a, right? a minor shoulder injury on your behalf.
Yeah, it was very kind of him. Sadly, it did not do the trick.
Sadly, no. And now, of course, a couple years later, you're raising a child with my former Grantland colleague, Louisa Thomas. You've published this book with her, which is, again, great. And you're scheduled to graduate from MIT next year.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
And I realize this is a dangerous question for me to ask as someone who is not especially smart. What sort of puzzles, what sort of math concepts are you working on right now?
Yes, so my thesis is going to be focused on something called clustering. And so for people who sort of are familiar with machine learning in any sense, I'm my thesis, part of it deals with sort of a classical area of machine learning called k-means clustering, which is familiar to some machine learning people. And, you know, if you are a machine learning person, the idea is you have some data set and you want to partition the data set into some number of parts such that you sort of recognize some sense of structure in your data. And this is one side of my thesis, and the other side is sort of the more theoretical sort of version of k-means, which is sort of what k-means came out of, which was this field that's a part of information theory called quantization, where information theory is sort of this very important field that was, you know, largely started by Claude Shannon that had to do with the sort of ideas of limits as to what you can and can't do with respect to sort of transferring information or recognizing information in some sense.
This is interesting. This is beyond, I have to admit, beyond the Coursera course I attempted to succeed at with machine learning. But I mean, it's really cool. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you've been published now, I believe. I mean, you're clearly very good at this. And I think it's really cool to see, you know, someone who admires you and admires, you know, the decisions you've made and admires the, you know, the amount of effort it took to do all the things you've done over the past few years, to see you succeeding at this.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I have to say, since I've retired, I've been enjoying so much just sort of, I've really put my whole life into sort of trying to be the best mathematician I can be and also just trying to be the best father I can be, sort of learning, reading math, doing research and lots of time, you know, playing with Joanna, playing with, you know, her little stuffed animals, reading her books. Somehow she, like, this girl will not tire of a book. Like, I'll read her a book and she'll make me read it to her like 10 more times. But it's been really enjoyable.
Okay, my last question. I also saw in an interview with you that you said the one class you can't believe you did well at Penn State was your freshman year English class?
Yes. So it's my freshman. It's the very first class I take, and it's sort of, it's like creative writing. Everyone at Penn State has to take it, and it's taught by this this woman, Kim Andrews, and I thought, I'm going to do so badly in this class because I'm so bad at creative writing. I don't really know what I'm doing. And yeah, it was a struggle for me, I have to admit.
But now, years later, you are about to be a published author.
Yes, but in my defense, I didn't have to make anything up. So maybe you should wait until, you know, till I release my first novella before you sort of judge how far I've come.
I wait for the anthology of fiction from you, Mr. Urschel. But if people want to check out this book, and again, I highly recommend it. Really enjoyed reading it. I read it in like one fell swoop. Like I did not put it down. Read it in like 2 hours. Really enjoyed it. It's Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football by John Urschel and Louisa Thomas. Really highly recommended. You should check it out. And John, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, thanks so much to my guests today. Two extremely smart people, way smarter than me. Two books I'd highly recommend you check out. Sprawl Ball by Kirk Goldsberry and Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football by John Urschel. Strongly recommend those books. Two really great people, two people I'm happy to be friends with, and two people who I think you should definitely check out their books. In addition, I think you should also check out the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, one of the many great podcasts here at ESPN, a show I subscribe to, another smart person who I am lucky enough to be friends with, and in addition, Lenny. I'm not friends with Lenny. Lenny has threatened to attack me multiple times when I've met Lenny, but I'm working on it. I think if I subscribe to the show, leave a good review, Lenny might consider being friends with me. And I have some news. We are going on a short hiatus. I am actually in Australia at the moment, having a great time. But we are going to take the next couple of weeks off. We will be back, I believe, in June. We're going to start with a few more NFL shows, start getting the season preview ready. But this is the quiet time for the NFL, and so I am taking a couple of weeks off. I apologize. Certainly check out Mina's show to fill in the gaps while I am gone. But thanks so much for listening, and more audio on the way in a couple weeks.